Check, check, 1, 2. Hey, hey, this is Kaya Lamont from ConcertCast.live. We make rockumentary podcasts exploring concert culture, and you're listening to Your Morning Coffee, the podcast with my friends Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchert. Weekly music news for the new music business. Take it away, boys.
For music business worldwide, over 38% of music on TikTok is modified, says study that analyzed 100 million audio tracks on the platform.
And from Live Nation, the truth about ticket prices.
And lastly, from The Guardian, the music industry's over-reliance on TikTok shows how lazy it has become. Wait a minute, Jay. Lazy in the music business?
You take that back.
Take that back. Oh, my goodness. Well, we've got this. We've got conversations with Martin Mills and Allison Hagendorf. We have got a wonderful show for you. We hope you're ready because we are. We're hitting the button right about now.
Stand by for transmission.
This is London calling.
Wake up! The revolution is at hand!
Your morning coffee is on the air.
Your morning coffee, the weekly music news for the new music business. It's the highly curated, agitated, advocated, moderated, and liberated digital music information that you need to know. We are your digital music authority. And now from our studios in Hollywood, California, here's your hosts, Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart.
Well, Jay, it is good to see you, my brother, on a Sunday, a time change Sunday here
yes.
in California.
Yes. Yeah, good to see you too. And welcome back from your vacation.
Thank you. Had a fun time in Maui, and the saddest faces that you'll ever see are the people heading back home at the airport from Maui. Yeah. And that was me yesterday, yeah. But I'm back and
those
happy to be back.
Relaxed, tanned faces.
Yes, there you go. And broke. Everybody's broke. All right, Jay. Well, listen, that we love documentaries, and that was Kyle Lamont from ConcertCast.live, I should say. They've launched a cool new rockumentary series, Check, Check, 1, 2. First episode is live. Check it out at concertcast.live/check-check.
Yeah, I watched little teaser video. It looked really good. And you're right. We love our documentaries. So thank you, Kyle. We had a couple of really great conversations that you mentioned this week. You know, Martin Mills was the first one. And, you know, if you don't know, I mean, Martin Mills, he's the founder and chairman of Beggars Group. You know, he founded Merlin. You know, he's also the chairperson.
Yeah. So last year, Merlin, the Independent Digital Music Licensing Partner, celebrated its 15th anniversary. Since its founding, Merlin has grown to represent 15% of the global recorded music market share, with a membership made up of independent record labels, distributors, label services companies, and other rights holders from 70-plus countries around the world.
Yeah, and as the industry and the technology has changed, Merlin has really continually evolved to sort of help independent music rights holders, and it helps them to compete on a level playing field. You know, it's these negotiated deals for its members, like partners like Apple, Deezer, Meta, Spotify, TikTok, YouTube, you know, they negotiate those deals and more than 36 other innovative platforms around the world, like Canva, Snap, Supernatural, and even Twitch, you know, introducing and representing independent music into social media, fitness apps, and even gaming. So this week, I asked Martin about streaming and why he feels it's, you know, the ideal business model for independence. That might surprise some people. I also asked him about, you know, what major developments he sort of foresees in the independent music world over the next several years. So let's listen in on that conversation I had with Martin Mills. Martin, thank you so much for joining me today. It's such an honor to meet you. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
So I've got a couple of questions for you. One is you're actually a big fan of streaming. That might surprise some people. Why is music streaming an ideal business model for independence?
There are quite a few surprising things I do in this company, one of which is to sign every payment. And that includes seeing every royalty statement that goes out every 6 months. And when I look at those royalty statements and when I think about the period during which streaming has been growing, pretty much all of our artists have benefited. It's pretty clear that not only has their physical income not changed very much, but the streaming income has been complementary to that. It's hard for me to think of any counterexamples to that. But I basically see more money going out to artists. And, you know, that's without commenting on the philosophical merits of streaming and what it does to people's listening habits and so on. And I totally appreciate the different arguments on that. But in terms of does it make you more money? Yes, it does. Not short term, but kind of midterm and long term.
What sort of major developments do you foresee for, you know, the independent music world over the next several years?
I think independents are always as strong as the music they put out. They also tend to kind of ride high when new genres are breaking, because new genres are generally espoused by independents. I think the biggest thing for us is we're looking at an increasingly concentrated marketplace. Obviously, we've been vocal over the years about the strengths of the individual majors, and particularly the biggest one. And I think we probably all have the right to be concerned about how big the biggest one is getting. And yeah, I think they're good market leaders, but if they dominate the market, then is that good? I think that's going to be a question for everyone.
Martin, thanks for taking the time out of your busy day. I hope to talk to you again. It's an honor.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's great. He's a very charming guy. I dealt with him a little bit when I was over at Warner Brothers Records back in the day. And he would come in and he knew everybody in the building, of course. And he was just, he has that sort of charming English way about him.
Yeah.
And of course, even at that time, he was so well known. And, you know, when I first met him, I was very nervous, but he was just, he's a super great guy. And,
yeah,
you know, love to see how he's sort of pivoted and doing all these new things. And he is just a force, man. Just
yeah.
a force.
He'd never thought that Merlin would become, you know, the juggernaut that it is. We had a really good conversation, and you and I were talking before we hit record. We should probably call him back and see if we can do just a special episode
yes.
with him. I mean, the stories
oh
he can tell. I mean, the experience he has.
Yeah.
The other conversation I had this week that you and I were talking about is with Allison Hagendorf. I spoke to her. She's got this really great show on YouTube and then, of course, on all the DSPs called The Allison Hagendorf Show.
Indeed. Premiering in celebration of International Women's Day and Women's History Month. The second season kicked off with debut Grammy Award-winning Hailstorm frontwoman Lizzie Hale, who was also recognized last week as part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's latest exhibit, Revolutionary Women in Music, Left of Center.
Yeah, and over the past 20 years, Allison has proudly advocated for female artists, starting as an A&R executive and continuing as the global head of rock at Spotify. And she's really provided a unique platform for artists to share their never-before-heard stories.
So weekly video episodes will drop every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern. That's 8 Pacific, where we are, on YouTube, Instagram, and Vivo, with the audio available on all streaming platforms.
Yeah, so let's listen in on that conversation. Allison, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day. First-time caller, long-time listener.
I appreciate it.
I love the Allison Hagendorf show. You got
Aww.
Season two coming. Season one, epic, you know, Royal Blood, Joan Jett, Dave Grohl. I mean, I could go on and on and on. But What I would like to talk to you about is these are not your typical rock star interviews. No. They're as much about the player as the game, so to speak. So talk about your approach to these conversations.
Sure. And thank you for all of this. And thank you for taking the time and having me on. But I guess my whole thing is it's really about less about genre and more about spirit, the rock and roll spirit. And in fact, I have a lot of guests who are not in rock and some guests that are actually not musicians. You know, it's just about, you know, music. We're all music fans at the end of the day. But I really look for guests, one who I respect as artists and I love their music, but really it's about storytelling. It's always about stories and storytelling. So I like to have guests on that want to share and celebrate their journeys, the good and the bad. And I think that's what resonates most with fans is just hearing their flaws, their obstacles, their accomplishments. It's all part of the process.
Yeah, but there's an art form to that because you and I were talking before we hit record about there are interviews and then there are sort of these deeper conversations. And you've sort of got this knack for building that trust and then allowing them to talk about that narrative.
Thank you. I think that the best way to have a great conversation are two things, establishing that trust and that safe space right off the bat. And two is listening. It's like I listen to so many podcasts and shows and there's like it's almost like the host is talking over the guest or they're really focused on what they want to share. But for me, it's all about listening. And inspiring a safe space for the guests to open up. And in some cases, I always want to talk about what the guest wants to talk about, you know, and let them take the lead. And sometimes guests in advance will be like, oh, I don't really want to talk about this. And I'm like, of course, I would never bring something up that they said not to bring. But once the conversation gets going and they feel comfortable, they end up bringing it up. And in fact, they end up bringing up a story that no one's even heard before, you know, that actually happened with Chris Daughtry. He came on the show and he's like, look, I don't want to talk about the loss of my daughter. I'm like, of course, there's no need to talk about that any further. And then he ended up bringing it up and he ended up sharing a story of their last conversation, you know, and it's, I think it's just, that's what is the most rewarding, fulfilling thing for me is to make my guests feel comfortable enough to share where it's almost a cathartic experience for them. And that's what's beautiful.
I love season one. I can't wait for season two. Sort of already kicked off. I loved your interview with Lindsay Hale from Hailstorm, Force of Nature. Tell me a little bit about what do you think's going to be happening in season two? Do you have any sneak peeks you can tell us about?
Sure. I will give you a sneak peek. I'm so excited. My guest this week is the legendary Nile Rodgers. And, you know, anytime you have an opportunity to be seated with greatness, it never gets lost on me. I'm like hanging on to every syllable. He's sharing stories about Miles Davis, you know, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Duran Duran. I mean, Daft Punk. We are lucky that he's alive in our lifetime and to be able to sit down with him. And for me, it's like, okay, we know he's the best of the best. But when I get to sit down with guests who are the greatest in their craft, but are also good people and are humble and gracious, I'm like, thank you. There is good in the world. So having Nile Rodgers next. And also we have some actors coming up. We have Chef Curtis Stone is on the show. You know, to me, like, he's a rock star. You know, it's that trailblazing, innovative rock star spirit.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, I'll always talk about music and stuff like that. But, yeah, it's really exciting.
Yeah, they're all creators. I just read the Rick Rubin book, and he talks about, you know, if you're doing a podcast, if you're making dinner, if you're making a garden, you're a creator. And as you're talking about actors, comedians, musicians, producers, that common thread, I think, is their creators. Where can people learn more about what you're building over there? Because, I mean, season one, if you haven't dug into it, you need to sort of go back and go through that. But where can people find you, Allison?
Sure. I'm excited about the show because it is both a video-first show. This season, we actually shoot it on a proper TV set, which is great. So people can watch it on YouTube or Instagram, or the audio is available everywhere on every podcast platform. So it's, on Instagram, I'm Allie Hagendorf, and then my YouTube channel is Allison Hagendorf. The advantage of having the name Allison Hagendorf is that I'm the only one. I'm the only one. So that is good.
Allison, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
That was a fun one, wasn't it?
Yeah, she's great. I could talk to her for hours. What I learned about Allison is that she's just like us. She's just a big music freak at heart, right? And I loved hearing her passion for all of these artists, and not just music artists. You know, she interviews, like she said in the discussion, she'll interview, you know, celebrities, writers, producers, comedians, anyone in the entertainment side. And you know, as we touched on in the conversation, like that Rick Rubin book, I love that passage where he talks about, you know, you're a creator. If you're making a garden, you know, if you're making a nice meal, if you're organizing your work, you don't have to be a musician to be a creator. And I believe that. So thank you, Allison, for talking with us this week.
Very, very cool. By the way, there is an updated 2024 YouTube best practices in the Daily Rind, the Orchards, their weekly. Is it weekly when they're comes out?
I don't know, but it's definitely their blog, their newsletter. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a fantastic guide to optimizing your YouTube channel as well as your videos. So make sure you want to print that one out.
Work.
And they do a great work over at the Orchard and all the stuff in the Daily Rind.
They really do. And that's in your morning coffee. So check that one out. Lot of great advice in there. And this stuff is evolving and changing. So it's always good to see these updates. And then just before we jump into the story, just a quick reminder that South by Southwest is underway. I'm going to be heading there tomorrow. I've got a really great panel on Wednesday, March 13th at the Austin Convention Center, room 17AB, if you're around. And it's called The Evolving Landscape of Record Labels for Artists, because it's changing and evolving so fast. It's changed while we've been having this conversation. I'm going to be speaking to some really smart people, Taylor Hansen, you know, from the band Hansen, Sherry Saidi, Nick Lipman. You know, these folks are very experienced, very smart. We're going to have some really great conversations at South by Southwest.
Be there or be square, as
thank you
like to say. Yes. And Jay, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about your other podcast, Behind the Set List, and you got another good one, Bare Naked Ladies.
God, yeah, those guys, if you can't have fun at a Bare Naked Ladies show, you may not have a pulse, as they say. It went live this last week, the conversation. Check that one out. We've got a couple of really good ones we've been teasing that are edited and ready to go. Coming up, we have Neil Finn, one of my favorite singer-songwriters ever. And one of my favorite conversations so far, and we've done, I think, maybe 40 or so of these behind the set list, and that's with Black Keys. And we talked about that a little bit last week. It was really special. So thank you for that. And please check out Behind the Set List, the podcast that I do with Glenn Peoples over at Billboard.
Yes, and the Bare Naked Ladies, when I was at Warner's, I think I was actually, speaking of Rick Rubin, I think I was a Deaf American across the street, but when the Bare Naked Ladies got signed to Sire, they came in the building and they had like an upright bass and one guitar, and maybe the drummer had like, I don't know, a snare and stuff, but they went around to literally every department in the building. And, you know, Warner's at that time in the old ski lodge building over by the studio. That was like three stories, I think. Let's see, top and then...
Well, there's a basement level.
So three floors, essentially. And they literally went to every department and they did a song. And I thought, that is a good way of ingratiating yourself with your label. Good for you guys.
Well, and to take off on that point, and then we'll jump into the stories, is we talked to Neil Finn about what he called the restaurant tour. So when Crowded House's first album came out, I think it was like around 1987 or so, I guess.
Yes, it was.
They went to these different markets, and I actually went to one of them and photographed it, and that was Seattle. And they performed at this beautiful restaurant. If you're familiar with Seattle, it's called Salty's. It's in West Seattle. It's right on the water, overlooking sort of the, you know, the Emerald City there. And Crowded House played in those suits from the first album. And I have these wonderful photographs of it. I sent some over. It was a magical night, but that was their restaurant tour. And Neil remembered it vividly. And he remembered the Capitol Records rep, our dear friend Astrid Guldenman, who was there, and it was really cool.
Well, and I remember when that, it's really probably the only time it's happened where I was working at SST at the time, and I was living in West Hollywood, and SST was way the hell down in the South Bay, so it was a long drive home, and I was driving home, and I heard Don't Dream It's Over on the radio. And I didn't go home. I went directly to Tower Records and I bought the record because it's like, and it was, it, and I just, it, actually, I didn't hear the full song. I heard the commercial for the album. So they just played like a snippet of that song. And I'm like, oh my God, what is that? And boom, went and bought it. And that record was so powerful.
Still one of my all time favorite albums, yes. Crowded House's debut album. I have it signed here in my office on the wall. Just a magic record. That's so cool.
Hard to believe that was back in 87.
I know, right?
Yeah. By the way, Jay, before we get started, we got to thank our sponsors because we got to go a big hell yeah shout out because we certainly appreciate it. The Your Morning Coffee podcast is brought to you by our friends at BandZoogle. For over 20 years, BandZoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single page electronic press kit in minutes. All the features you need to design an EPK are already built in, including fully customizable templates, preset EPK page layouts, music players, images, text bio and video embeds, a gig calendar and press quotes, and access to BandZoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 a month, and Your Morning Coffee podcast listeners can jump over to BandZoogle.com, try it free for 30 days, then use the promo code MorningCoffeeEPK, which is all one word, to get 10% off the first year of the new EPK plan subscription. That's BandZoogle.com. Promo code MorningCoffeeEPK when you sign up to the EPK plan.
Yes, and we're honored to be sponsored by Hypebot. Since 2004, Hypebot has chronicled the new music industry and the trends and technologies that are changing how music is discovered, consumed, marketed, and monetized. It's edited daily by founder Bruce Houghton. Hey, Bruce. With help from Alana Bonilla, Hypebot and sister blog Music Think Tank are published by live music discovery and marketing platform Bands in Town.
Indeed, Bands in Town. Over 80 million live music fans trust Bands in Town to get personalized concert alerts, recommendations, and messages from their favorite artists, which I just did, by the way. We're going to try to go see Lord Huron down in San Diego.
Nice.
It's the number one artist service platform connecting over 590,000 artists with their super fans. Managers, labels, agencies, and artists access their own dashboard to manage and promote their tour dates across all platforms.
Yes, sir. And finally, the Music Business Association. They put on the Music Biz Conference, and that it's one of the best conferences out there. And it really creates the rooms in which important conversations that shape the future of our industry, it's where they take place. Representing more than 90% of the industry at large, the association serves as the connective tissue for the global music business and provides a trusted forum where ideas and collaborations can flourish. So join me for the Music Biz 2024 conference, May 13th through the 16th in Nashville. I'll be moderating a panel with some very smart music marketers. Hope to see you there.
Indeed. Big thanks to BandZoogle, Hypebot, Bands in Town, and the Music Business Association. We, Jay and me, certainly appreciate it. And me and Jay, who is Jay, you say? Well, he's a music industry consultant. He's the curator of the weekly Your Morning Coffee newsletter and a former executive with Universal Music, Sony Music, and Warner Music Groups. And he is a digital music shaman.
I don't know. Thank you. Whatever. I appreciate it. And this gentleman sitting across from me, tanned and relaxed, is Michael Etchart, my dear friend and longtime host of Sound and Vision Radio, formerly of SST Records, so cool, Warner Music, Capital EMI, and Universal Music Group, where we first met and bonded over bootlegs and power pop and books and documentaries. And by the way, you were telling me about a couple of books that you just finished on your vacation, one of which I read, but the other one I can't wait to read. Tell the audience about those two books that you just finished.
Yeah, so Joel Selvin's new book is Drums and Demons, The Tragic Journey of Jim Gordon. And Jim Gordon, as you may know, probably the most, well, certainly the most sampled drummer of all time. He was a session guy. He was part of the Wrecking Crew, and he was in Derek and the Dominoes, and tragically killed his mom in the early 80s. And he just passed away. We talked about him, I think, briefly when he passed away. And this book is really amazing and very interesting, very tragic, but also very sympathetic. And, you know, you and I have talked a lot about mental issues of musicians on the show. And boy, this guy was just an unbelievable tragic case of schizophrenia and really sad. And then I read go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say really quickly, Joel Selvin is, you know, a legend. And we had him on the Music Biz Weekly podcast and had a great conversation with him. I mean, just an iconic writer, journalist, just a great guy.
Oh, yeah. Easily 20 books he's written on music related. They're great. And then, of course, I read Kenneth Womack's Living the Beatles Legend, The Untold Story of Mal Evans, the longtime Beatles roadie / valet / bodyguard / everything.
Yeah.
And another very kind of a tragic story. Again, you know how it ends before you pick up the book. And if you don't know, he was kind of suicide by police, as they say, in LA in the mid-70s. And it's a fascinating book. And I think you mentioned it as well. You were both pretty Beatly geeky guys.
Yeah.
And we've read all the books.
Yeah.
And even this one had a bunch of stuff I didn't know.
Me too. Well, he kept meticulous diaries.
He did.
From like 1962 to 74 or so. And so you get some things from the inside that nobody else would have seen or known. Just a wonderful, wonderful book. Sad ending, yes, but still there's a lot of joy in it as well.
Well, and one of the heroes of the book is Yoko Ono, and one of the interesting things is before he died, he was planning on doing this memoir, and after his death, the all of the elements kind of just sat in the basement of one of the publishing companies in New York, and a temp, a woman who was a bit of a Beatles fan, found it all, and tried to alert the people upstairs, the people that she was working for, hey, this is pretty important stuff. And they kind of ignored her. And so she went over to the Dakota and wrote a letter to Yoko, who she did not know, and gave it to the doorman. And Yoko got on it and was able to return the stuff to the family. And and finally, he was killed in 75 and talking about the book. And this stuff happened in the late 80s, but it took this long for the book to come out. It was really interesting.
Yeah, it could have easily gone into the trash heap. So,
yes, exactly. Yeah. All right, Jay. Well, let's jump into the stories. The first one from our number one story is Music Business Worldwide Stat of the Week. Over 38% of TikTok is modified, says a study that analyzed 100 million audio tracks on the platform. It starts to say copyrighted music has been modified by TikTok users with its pitch or speed adjusted and subsequently uploaded to the platform, and which, as a result of that modification, evades straightforward copyright detection and also market share attribution.
Yeah, we've been talking about how people speed up, slow down, reverb music. But it's not theirs to do that with. Of course, it still happens. So how much of the music on TikTok is modified in this way? According to one industry platform, analytics platform, a material amount. According to a new study from PEX, they do great work, by the way. They monitor and analyze copyrighted content on digital services. TikTok has the most modified audio of all the major UGC, that stands for user-generated content, all major UGC platforms, including YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram.
So PEX estimates that comfortably more than a third, talking about 38% of all songs found on TikTok, were speed or pitch modified in 2023. PEX analyzed a sample of around 100 million tracks on TikTok for its latest study across more than 20 platforms. TikTok included over a 12-month period, that was January of 2023 to just this January of 2024.
38%. Oh my God. So here's a few highlights from the article. Unless these million plus tracks have legally licensed the original recording on which they're based, they're infringing copyright. And I'm not thinking that many of these were licensed. This doesn't only affect music streaming, but also impacts UGC social platforms like TikTok, as highlighted by PEX's study.
So according to Pex, rising in popularity, modified audio remixes often divert royalty payments away from rights holders and into the hands of other creators. Many of these songs aren't licensed, and as such, the ownership information for them directs to the creator of the modified track, not to any of the original rights holders. Oh my God.
Yeah, so without a license or proper attribution, rights holders won't see any credit or payment from the use of their songs. 38%. I thought that was absolutely
huge.
Stunning. And there was so much news about TikTok. You know, we've been talking about UMG and MPA and all of these issues going on with TikTok. And but there was an article in Billboard, and the headline was "Independent Music Publishers Could Leave TikTok in May." And this is a big deal. The NMPA, which is the National Music Publishers Association, said that their TikTok license, which is used by a number of indie publishers, it's set to expire April 30th. The organization says it's not likely to renew or extend it.
Whoa. This means that a lot more music could be removed from TikTok come May, spreading the reach of recent music takedowns far beyond what users have already experienced since Universal Music Group began pulling its recorded music and publishing catalogs off the platform in the last month. The NMPA license is used by a number of independent music publishers, but the organization has previously declined to specify which ones.
Yeah, so we don't really know yet which ones those are. The NMPA is known for its aggressive approach to licensing negotiations with social media sites, streaming services, gaming platforms. This last week, it was announced that a federal judge will now allow the NMPA's multi-million-dollar lawsuit against X, the artist formerly known as Twitter. And the NMPA has also similarly fought back against Twitch, Roblox, and even Pandora in recent years.
Wow. That is going to be fascinating. This is from Music Business Worldwide. How much music is currently being affected by the Universal situation?
Yeah.
A TikTok spokesman told Music Business Worldwide this week that in the US and UK, UMG and UMPG, Universal Music Publishing Group combined, comprises approximately 30% of popular music on the platform, and even less everywhere else.
Yeah, but senior music industry sources, however, have disagreed with that assessment. Speaking to Music Business Worldwide, a number of music executives, they estimate that it's somewhere between 60% and 80% of quote-unquote relevant repertoire on TikTok, in other words, current and proven hits, would be impacted by TikTok's removal of UMG's combined publishing and recorded music repertoire.
So in an analysis of the UMG versus TikTok situation published this week, JP Morgan analyst Daniel Kurven estimated that TikTok would lose access to a total of 5 million songs as a result of the removal of the UMG recordings catalog, combined with the deletion of additional UMPG, that's the publishing group, repertoire. Michael Nash, UMG's EVP and chief digital officer, said, "Are you talking about popular music as we think about it? Are you talking about all audio content, which might include sound effects and a lot of AI content? Mm. Obviously, we don't think that kind of non-copyrighted audio should be part of any artist royalty pool calculation."
Interesting. There was another piece that I thought was really interesting about TikTok in the news this week. And the headline was, "The music industry's over-reliance," excuse me, "on TikTok shows how lazy it's become." And that was from The Guardian. Critics say that TikTok encourages artists to create a certain kind of music that seems designated to go viral, whatever that means. Often the ploy works, evidenced by the proliferation, it's easy for you to say, of hits that utilize bold, easily recognizable samples like from the 90s and the 2000s.
Yeah, it's also hugely debatable as to whether TikTok virality can translate into lasting success. U.S. artist Steve Lacy made headlines in 2022 after complaining that fans at his shows were only there to film a snippet of him playing his viral song Bad Habit. New Zealand artist Benny, who hit the U.S. charts in 2020 with her pandemic viral song Super Lonely, has since failed to replicate that success.
Yeah, and even over this last year, another problem has emerged, and that, you know, such a high volume of songs go viral on TikTok every day that fewer and fewer of those viral songs make an impact outside of TikTok. Last year, most of the viral songs on the platform that found real-world success were by established artists such as Doja Cat, Central C, both of whom admittedly initially found fame via the platform, with only a few songs such as South African singers Tyla Wader, K-pop band 5050's Cupid, genuinely breaking through.
So all this is to say, TikTok's relationship with the music industry was never sustainable. As many digital media outlets realized in the mid-2010s when they pivoted to video, in quotation marks, in an attempt to placate Facebook's algorithm, only for the bottom to fall out of that platform, it's never wise to place the fate of an entire industry in the hands of a private company whose motivations and modes of operation are opaque at best. Big stars who already have built-in fan bases and effective marketing machines won't be profoundly affected by their music being off TikTok, but new stars certainly will.
Yeah, it seems unlikely that Universal will reverse the decision until TikTok agrees to higher compensation rates for artists, which itself doesn't seem like a sure thing. For all the short-term damage that the move may cause to emerging artists, though, it seems that this seismic event will be a wake-up call for a lot of people. It reveals just how lazy so much of the industry has become, pursuing virality on one extreme fickle platform at the expense of everything else. It probably will require many to instead pursue what they've become increasingly allergic to, some genuinely new marketing ideas. We highly recommend that you read Ari Herstand's guest column in Variety this last week. There's a link in your morning coffee. The headline is "Who's Getting Hurt in the Universal Music TikTok Standoff? Artists and Songwriters." Great piece by Ari Herstand. Great. There was just so much news this week about TikTok and UMG, NMPA, all of this stuff that we couldn't get to everything in the podcast, but definitely check it out in the newsletter.
So I'm thinking more and more that it seems like TikTok just has to blink. But will they? That's really the question. Will they?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Our last story, Jay, it's from Live Nation. The truth about ticket prices. This is by Dan Wall. And the ongoing antitrust attacks on Live Nation and Ticketmaster, a constant theme is that their alleged monopolies are responsible for high ticket prices. Rhetorically, that's understandable, because if you want to rile up fans against Live Nation and Ticketmaster, there is no better way than to blame them for something you know fans dislike. But is there really a connection between any of these antitrust arguments and prices for concert tickets? That is the subject of that day's post.
Yeah, the starting point is what Live Nation and Ticketmaster actually do. What roles do they play in the concert industry, and what power does that give them to influence ticket prices? Well, we'll start with Ticketmaster, since it tends to get the lion's share of the blame for the high ticket prices, even though, as we will see, it has the least influence over prices.
Right. So how ticketing works. Ticketmaster and other primary ticketing companies provide the technology and services that venues need to manage and market shows, sell tickets, and validate tickets for entry. Typically, one primary ticketing company provides these services for all events at a given venue. The chosen ticketing company then interfaces with consumers on online marketplaces, not to sell inventory of their own, but as agents of the venue selling tickets priced by performers and production entities. And that's very interesting. Priced by performers and production entities. Fans tend not to understand that. They think of Ticketmaster as an enormous ticket retailer that acquires vast quantities of tickets and puts them up for sale at prices Ticketmaster determines. An assumption that makes it easy to blame Ticketmaster for high prices. But that's just not true.
Yeah, and as you point out, tickets are actually priced by artists, and their teams. And we learned that, and we're trying to shout that from the rooftops, because a lot of these artists actually participate in these fees, which we'll get into in a minute. It's really their show. They get to decide what costs get in. The NFL tickets on Ticketmaster were priced by the home teams. Concert tickets were priced by the performer's business teams. Monster Jam tickets were priced by its producer, Feld Entertainment, and so on. So the truth about fees, the argument that Ticketmaster is responsible for high prices is really about service charges. The practice in the U.S. for decades has been to break down the cost of admission into a quote-unquote face value sum and one or more fees added to that value. There is a common perception that service charges are quote-unquote junk fees and that Ticketmaster sets these fees and pockets the money. Again, let's not let facts get in the way of a good story. That's just not true.
Service charges are added to the face value of concert tickets because two important players in the concert ecosystem, that's venues and primary ticketing companies, get little or nothing out of the revenues derived from the ticket's face value. That money goes mostly to the performers, secondarily to cover certain show costs, and if anything is left over, to the promoters. So the practice developed to add a percentage service charge to a ticket's face value to pay the venue for hosting the event and the primary ticketing company for servicing venues and distributing tickets. The add-on nature of the service fee is annoying to many fans and fuels the narrative that these fees are junk fees. But they are not junk fees for the simple reason that the venues and ticketing companies have costs associated with the services they provide to help produce the show. They provide value, and one way or another will be compensated for it.
Right. Fans are also told that service charges are Ticketmaster's way of raising ticket prices. In fact, Ticketmaster does not set service charges. Venues do. And most of the money goes to the venues. So let's break that down. Primary ticketing service charges are a product of the hundreds of contracts that exist between venues and their exclusive ticketing providers. They are not uniform, but a typical contract will provide that in exchange for its services and some guaranteed cash payments to the venue. The ticketing company will get a stated percentage of the service charge the venue intends to impose, a dollar per ticket fee or some combination of the two. The venue decides on the service fees. The venue does. During the ticketing contract bidding process, the venue tells the bidding ticketing companies that it intends to charge certain fees, and the ticketing companies structure their offers, accordingly.
However, the contract turns out the venue gets most of the service fee, not Ticketmaster or any other primary ticketing company. In fact, the venue normally gets about 2/3 of the service charge and in many cases a facility fee as well. So if fees add, say, 30% to the face value of a ticket, the primary ticketing company is getting perhaps a quarter of that, something in the range of 5 to 7%. And the primary ticketing company is not making 5 to 7% per ticket as profit because it has costs to cover, not the least of which are the guaranteed payments to the venue it needed to promise to win the contract. A primary ticketing company's profit per ticket is closer to about 2% of the average ticket price, a figure far too low to be the cause of high ticket price.
Wow, 2%. So, but let's ignore costs and just ask whether getting a 5 to 7% commission on the sale of a concert ticket is abnormal or unreasonable, 5 to 7%. In today's economy, we have a lot of data points about digital distribution, and what those costs are. We can, for example, compare Ticketmaster's 5 to 7% commission rate with what other digital distribution platforms charge. And they have a really great chart in this article. The fact that the 5 to 7% fee that primary ticketing companies earn on ticket sales is extremely low by the standards of digital distribution. Here's how it stacks up against a collection of other fees charged by online marketplaces. And they have this chart that shows, StubHub will charge 37%. PlayStation will charge 30%. The App Store, Apple will charge 30% for the first 12 months. Uber, 25%. Airbnb, 17.2%. And then you compare that to Ticketmaster's 5 to 7%. It doesn't quite seem as outrageous. And look, I don't like paying extra fees. I don't like paying for expensive concert tickets, but I think there's three sides to every story, right? Yours, mine, and the truth. It's nice to sort of dig in and look at what the facts are.
Absolutely. So if distribution makes up to 25%, 37%, or 50% of what a consumer pays of something, of course it bears some responsibility for the ultimate price. But at just 5 to 7%, there is no rational basis for thinking that primary ticketing companies are really the cause of high concert ticket prices. They charge too little, and even if one were to assume without any evidence that there is some amount of unjustified monopoly profit in a 5 to 7% commission, it would not affect ticket prices by more than 1 or 2% at worst. So the narrative that Ticketmaster fees are responsible for high ticket prices really makes no sense. There is no way that that can be true.
Okay, well, let's talk about the role of the promoter. Let's consider Live Nation in its role as a concert promoter. The argument we hear about Live Nation's role in concert pricing, that they're inconsistent, some claim that Live Nation is so powerful in concert promotion that it can dictate what artists charge. Others claim that Live Nation can raise its prices to artists, and this gets passed through to fans in higher ticket prices. But neither argument is really plausible.
So concert promoters provide an array of services related to putting on memorable and financially successful concerts. They help the performers secure the right venues, negotiate deals with venues and others, advise on pricing, market the shows, and manage the countless details involved in hosting a concert. But promoters don't get paid for their services directly the way a lawyer or an accountant might. Concert promoters invest in the show or tour by guaranteeing their performers a certain amount of money on the hope and expectation that there will be some profit for the promoter after the performers have been paid and all show costs have been covered. Promoters, in other words, are risk takers. They bankroll the show, hoping it turns out to be profitable, but the risks they make their compensation uncertain.
Right, there's a lot of risk involved there. Promoters also, they don't set ticket prices. They care deeply about pricing and are usually quite sophisticated about it because the offers they make to artists necessarily anticipate and depend on the number of and the prices for tickets likely to be sold. Think about a simple guarantee to an artist of, let's say, $100,000 for one show at a 5,000 seat venue. There's no way for a responsible promoter to offer that guarantee without at least general understanding of what those 5,000 tickets will sell for. This is the same reason why the investors on Shark Tank ask potential partners how much they charge for their products. If your money is at risk, you pay attention to pricing.
Yes, you do. Nevertheless, promoters don't set prices, unless we should probably underline this, but artists do. The artist and her business team listen to the promoter's input and then decide. This is the case even when a promoter as large as Live Nation or AEG. Furthermore, if you want to talk to about a promoter's pricing incentives, the last thing a concert promoter wants to do is charge too much for a show. That is a surefire way for the promoter to lose money. The promoter's incentive is to find the sweet spot that balances ticket revenues and the profitability of a sellout. That's what gives promoters a reasonable chance of making money on the show. There's even less merit to the idea that the promoter's take from a concert pushes up ticket prices. Concert promotion services are not remotely expensive enough, let alone profitable enough to have that effect.
Yeah, he goes on to say that a promoter's compensation is a product of numerous terms in its contract with the artist. The most important are the guarantee to the artist, the artist's percentage of revenues after ticket sales exceed the guarantee, and the terms defining the expenses that the promoter is allowed to recover. The guarantee is a fixed amount, and it's paid by the promoter to the artist, regardless of whether the promoter loses money or not. For example, a band might be guaranteed $100,000, in which case it will be paid $100,000, irrespective of whether the concert makes money or not. The band may even make more if the show is successful. However, because through the artist's percentage, the band will also be entitled to a substantial part of any net ticket revenues. Nowadays, it's common for top artists to get 90% or more of the net ticket revenues. The promoter only gets what remains after that guarantee. Other show costs and the artist percentage, they've been paid out. that depends critically on how many tickets are sold, which is unknown until the night of the show. To further complicate things, every deal is different, and artists vary wildly widely about their popularity and bargaining power. Promoter prices, whatever one chooses that to mean, vary from deal to deal.
What we can say is that the concert promotion is not a highly profitable business, even for Live Nation. In its annual reports, Live Nation reports billions of dollars of revenue for its concert segment because the acts it promotes sell billions of dollars in tickets. But Live Nation's own income as a concert promoter is less than 2% of concert revenues. The concerts segment adjusted operating income margin in 2023 was, check this out, 1.7%. On that basis alone, it is obvious that what Live Nation earns as a concert promoter can't be responsible for high ticket prices. It is not nearly enough of the ticket revenue to force up ticket prices meaningfully. And despite all the talk that Live Nation is becoming more and more powerful, the secular trend in the industry is that artists are getting an increasingly large share of ticket revenues. Concert promotion is an attractive business today largely because of its relationship to selling corporate sponsorships, an advertising business in which money comes neither from artists nor fans, but from big corporations.
Yeah. So we're left then with a ticketing distribution monopoly that charges a fraction of what most digital platforms charge, and a concert promotions monopoly, in quotation marks, with a 1.7 AOI margin. And neither sets ticket prices. Remember, the artist does that and their teams. So what really causes high ticket prices? The real explanations for high ticket prices are well understood and have very little to do with Live Nation or Ticketmaster. They begin with the economic conditions that explain most pricing, supply and demand. For a small percentage of concerts, the high profile ones, consumer demand is greatly exceeds the supply of tickets. We saw that, you know, with Taylor Swift. You know, this is obvious, you know, in the industry where stars like Taylor Swift, Beyonce, Ed Sheeran, Bruce Springsteen, Harry Styles, they could easily sell out far more shows than they could realistically even play. But it's not just them. For the top 5 to 10% of all touring artists, demand is regularly well in excess of the supply of tickets. We are fortunate that artists in this category choose not to exercise their full pricing power. Otherwise, they would charge much higher prices, you know, we see on resale markets. Basic economics applies to concert tickets too. So strong demand naturally leads to high ticket pricing.
Closely related to this is the phenomenon of concerts becoming premier, and this is in quotation marks, experience goods. Much has been written about the advent of the experience economy, in which economic value has shifted progressively from the production and supply of goods to the delivery of services and now to the staging of experiences. Music, whether recorded or live, is by its nature experienced, but plainly the live experience is richer and, in economic terms, more valuable. Concerts also have the potential to become spectacles, whether through elaborate staging and production or a consumer buzz that makes them the place to be, in quotation marks. This factor is magnified by social media, which, in addition to creating demand through ongoing connections to artists, allows concerts to be shared experiences when fans upload videos and Instagrammable moments to their social media platforms. The experience value of concerts has been increasing for decades, and with it, the price of tickets.
FOMO, fear of missing out, right? Artists have become more dependent on touring income over the last 25 years. The fact that Alan Krueger, who served as the chairman of President Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, cited the primary reason why concert prices have risen so much since the late 1990s. This is the direct result of a precipitous decline in the value of recorded music because of streaming and unauthorized duplication. And that led drastically to lower record sales, which in turn led record companies to withdraw from their traditional role, bankrolling touring. You know, in that environment, concerts could no longer be loss leaders to sell albums. They became the artist's principal source of income, and they were priced accordingly.
Right. So one of the big things is how resale impacts prices. So finally, the rise of today's mammoth online resale markets has profoundly affected concert pricing. It has done so by undermining to a degree the long-standing practice of performers to substantially underprice tickets to their performances, especially the best seats to the hottest shows. Artists underprice tickets for several reasons, but mostly out of regard for their fans. There is a kind of social compact between performers and their devoted fans to charge them fair prices, not whatever the market will bear. StubHub and the resale marketplace that followed it changed that forever by presenting artists with 24/7 reminders of what the true market value for their tickets is, and that when they don't charge those prices, scalpers will find a way to acquire tickets and resell them at full market value. That unquestionably affects what artists charge. They still don't charge what the market will bear, not even for the best seats, but most charge more for the best seats than they would in the absence of all of that scalping.
Yeah. Well, the common thread to all these factors is that they have nothing to do with the promoter and who they are and who sells tickets to the show. What Taylor Swift charges has nothing to do with whether she is promoted by Live Nation, which she is not, Louis Messina of AEG, which she is. What Beyonce charges has nothing to do with whether Ticketmaster or SeatGeek, you know, serves the venue she chooses to play. Either way, the performer's business team will work with their chosen promoter and try to come up with a pricing strategy that strikes the right balance between the economic returns from the tour and doing right by their fans. The first part of that will turn mainly on data-driven judgments about demand. How did the performer's last tour sell, and at what prices? What are comparable artists charging in similar venues, you know, in this tour cycle? How strong is the demand for concerts generally at this time? It's amazing. There's so much at play here. And I before we finish this up, I want to make sure that I was just thinking about this interview with Bob Lefsetz on his podcast with Michael Rapino. And he's the CEO and president of Live Nation Entertainment. But he breaks down a lot of the fees and a lot of the things that are in this article to sort of dispel some of these myths. And I highly recommend people check that out.
Well, if nothing else, it's this entire conversation and dialogue and you know, the awareness of this is really kind of shining a light on the realities of what is going on behind the scenes. And I think that is a good thing. But it's a lot to learn and a lot to know. And like we said, kind of at the top, it's so easy to just get pissed off at the obvious big bullies, Ticketmaster, et cetera. But the reality is that this is, you know, so much of this, all of this really comes back to the artists and their teams. You know, what are they charging and how much are we going to end up paying? It's a wacky world and full of lots of economic realities, right?
Absolutely.
Supply and demand.
Yeah, and there was one thing that I learned that surprised me. This was, I don't know, a year or two ago when you and I were talking about ticket pricing, and that was some of these fees that are charged. There are some that are charged that the revenue goes mainly back to the artist, and some where they just participate. But nobody was really talking about that. And so some of these artists were getting up in arms about some of these fees. But the truth was that they were actually participating financially in some of those fees. Mm-hmm. So whether there was ignorance or, you know, they were, you know, ignoring it on purpose. But it's nice to sort of see both sides to every story. And again, you know, I don't like paying high prices. And you and I were talking about, you know, at a Paul McCartney show, there were no cheap seats. And then somebody explained to us that if they did drop that section and drop the prices really low, that some of these secondary market players would just come in and scoop them up and sell them for what the market will bear. Nice. I mean, I hate, there was a concert recently where, you know, if you wanted to go to the concert, you're talking north of $300 per ticket, plus parking, plus, you know, merch or meals or whatever. And it's getting so, in some cases, you know, only the rich can survive and, you know, go to these shows. And that's, it's not good, but I love seeing how, you know, what the truth is to some of these fees that we're talking about.
Yeah, for sure. Well, on that note, Jay, let's wrap up the show. We want to tell you all, if you enjoy the show, please tell one friend. Jay and I would certainly appreciate that. And we want to thank our good friends at Bandzoogle, Hypebot, Bands in Town, and the Music Business Association for rocking our world every week. Could not do it without you guys, so big thanks. And thanks to the listeners. We certainly appreciate your constant support. And Jay and I, it is not lost on us at all. So thank you so much, and we'll be back next week on the Your Morning Coffee Podcast.
You've been listening to Your Morning Coffee, the weekly music news program for the new music business. Join Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart next time for the digital music news you need to know.